British unions say the current rail strikes could mark the start of a, quote, summer of discontent, with more workers heading for industrial action amid rising inflation. Russian forces pushing deeper into Donbass after they capture Ukraine's Tashkivka village near the twin cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk, the site of fierce fighting. The leader of France's Conservative Party says arrogant Emmanuel Macron must make compromises after losing control of Parliament. This is World News. I'm Bechter Znashev. You're welcome. Tens of thousands of railway workers in Britain are walking off their jobs, bringing rail transport nationwide to a standstill. Some 50,000 Britons are refusing to work at the biggest strike in more than three decades. Train services will also be canceled on Thursday and Saturday. Strikers protesting their low wages as inflation has pushed 10%. Last-ditch talks over the workers' demands have failed to break the impasse. London's Underground also remains shut due to a separate strike causing commuter chaos. The opposition Labour Party is criticizing the government to Prime Minister Boris Johnson for failing to resolve the dispute. Johnson has reacted to the strikes, calling them wrong and unnecessary.
Good morning. I want to say something about the rail strikes that are today causing significant disruption and inconvenience up and down the country, making it more difficult for people to get to work, risking people's appointments, making it more difficult for kids to sit exams, all sorts of unnecessary aggravation this is going to cause. And I want to emphasise to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong and so unnecessary.
Johnson also warned that the strike would harm businesses that are still recovering from the coronavirus pandemic. The strike action has already caused major disruption, leaving the stations deserted. But a strike leader saying the campaign will run for as long as necessary. The government is facing pressure over its economic policies as the cost of living crisis is pushing millions to the brink. Unions have spoken of what they call a summer of discontent, involving more strikes by teachers and medics, among other workers in different sectors. Saeed Purizan in London has joined us for the details on the rail strike in the UK.
The government is saying that the rail network has to achieve what they call financial sustainability. That has meant potentially, from the standpoint of the RMT, the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, which some would say is a militant union, but has a lot of clout, has a lot of power, would lead to the loss of several hundred jobs. And that's what they're trying to prevent by staging this strike today and in the coming days. The argument on the part of the government is that they have to achieve financial sustainability. They had to be bailed out post-pandemic because of the impact the pandemic had, and the 25% drop in ticket purchases by commuters. At the same time, wages have been suppressed to control inflation that has been impacted by a long list of things, from Brexit to the pandemic to the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine. So we're going to see this in the coming days as people continue to experience travel misery as a result of these strikes. And this is not the first one. It's the this itself is the fourth in the year, and we're going to see similar action happening in the coming days by teachers, by nurses, generally NHS workers and staff, as we go ahead in the coming weeks and months.
Now, Russia warning NATO member Lithuania of serious negative consequences in case it refuses to lift a recently announced ban on rail transit of goods to Russia's Kaliningrad region. Moscow has promised to defend its national interests and summoned the EU ambassador over the ban. Lithuania says the ban is in line with the bloc sanctions over Russia's offensive in Ukraine. The war, which began nearly 4 months ago, is now focusing on Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. Russian troops are going deeper there by taking two more towns. To the southwest, Russia has hit an airfield near the city of Odessa with missiles. It says the strikes were in response to Ukraine's Monday attack on its gas production platforms in the Black Sea. Now, more Ukraine news. The Kremlin says the two Americans who were caught fighting Russian forces in Ukraine have committed crimes and will have to be punished. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov said two were endangering Russian lives by firing it and shelling military personnel. According to Peskov, Russia cannot guarantee they won't face the death penalty. He says the nature of their crimes will be investigated. These are the first official comments from Moscow about the two Americans after the U.S. Department said it had seen reports of their seizure. Both captives are reportedly U.S. military veterans. Earlier, a Russian-banked court sentenced two Britons to death for fighting as mercenaries alongside the Ukrainian army. Johnny Miller provides us with a wider picture of foreign nationals who are caught fighting alongside the Ukrainian army against Russia.
Well, there's thousands of foreign fighters fighting for the Ukrainian army. Russia calls them mercenaries. A lot of Brits, a lot of Americans particularly. So it was only a matter of time until some Americans got captured. So we'll have to wait and find, to see their fate. There's fears that they could be sentenced to the death penalty, just like, as you say, two British fighters who are fighting for Ukraine. Now, Russia, they are, the West is claiming that they should be treated as POWs, but pro-Russian forces say that, according to the Geneva Conventions, they should be treated as mercenaries, and therefore they're allowed to be tried in a criminal court. So that's very much the difference. Russia is, and the DPR have captured thousands of Ukrainian soldiers. There's evidence to suggest they are being treated reasonably well. But these Americans and Brits are a different story. So I have seen evidence that the two British soldiers who were sentenced to death, there's evidence to suggest that the Russians are trying to get them swapped for some high-profile prisoners that the Ukraine have, particularly the politician Medvedchuk, who is a high-profile pro-Russian Ukrainian detainee in Ukraine. And there's evidence to suggest that the Russians are trying to swap the Brits for high-profile prisoners, but there hasn't been any swapping there. But this is ultimately what the sentence they will get will be largely political. Two Americans captured by the pro-Russians or the Russians is clearly a high-profile negotiating tool for them.
The United States and Russia extended a crucial nuclear arms control treaty known as a New START until 2026, and that after President Joe Biden took the helm. But there are worries whether the world's biggest possessors of nukes would be able to extend their last remaining nuclear treaty. We've discussed that issue further in our news review program a short time ago.
A top Russian official says holding nuclear arms reduction talks with the U.S. is pointless, suggesting that Moscow should wait until Americans come forth and beg for negotiations. The former president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, believes that there is no need to negotiate nuclear disarmaments with the U.S. yet, because it is bad for Russia. Medvedev says that Washington and Moscow don't have any relations now, and therefore everything is, in his own words, a dead zone. As Russia's President Medvedev signed the New START Treaty in 2010 with then U.S. President Barack Obama. The treaty was extended in 2021 for 5 years, but fears of a renewed arms race are now on the rise amid critically sour relations over the war in Ukraine. Russia and the U.S. are the world's biggest nuclear powers. They control about 90% of the global atomic arsenal. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from Moscow. We also have Greg Simmons, who's an author and researcher, joining us from Uppsala. Welcome to you both. So let me first start with our guest there from Moscow, Fred Weir. When Russia says that the U.S. should come begging for having talks on this, I believe it's the fact that they don't have relations with the U.S., even though they may be interested, obviously, in this, and that is why they are saying that. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know. I'm one of those people who would say that nuclear arms control talks should be held on any given day, regardless of what else is going on. But it is a fact that there is virtually no communication between the two sides, and hasn't been for some time. It's just as bad as it could be in that respect. The Americans are acting in ways the Russians regard as extremely hostile in other areas. And one of the things, if to make sense of this from my own perspective, it is that the Russians have consistently throughout this war, it's now almost four months, they have stood up their nuclear deterrent, pointed to it, and said, we have this. Their purpose in doing that is to deter NATO from getting directly involved in the Ukraine conflict. And so I can only see this as part of that. We're not talking about reductions or controls on nuclear weapons as long as this other stuff is going on. They're just underlining it to highlight this aspect of this overall crisis.
Well, if we were to take a look at the way that it seems like Russia is reacting to the whole issue, Greg Simmons, not to say that they're antagonizing the U.S., but basically they're saying when they're being treated the way that they have been by the U.S., along with its allies, but mainly the U.S., then even talking about it is useless. Of course, what Fred Weir says there is very important, and that is the fact that they just want to make sure on the possession that they are showing that to the U.S., so obviously for this not to be used.
Yeah, well, I mean, what Fred Weir says, it makes absolutely perfect sense. And, I mean, I agree fully. One should also take into account the rather checkered history of U.S. negotiations. I mean, Iran knows what the U.S. word is worth, or what an agreement is worth with the JCPOA. I mean, the United States has also been withdrawing from numerous arms control treaties which it has signed, or not renewing them. So, I mean, it has this history of bad faith negotiations.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That is Greg Simmons, who spoke to us from Uppsala, author and researcher. And Fred Weir, thank you so much, journalist and political commentator from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
All right, moving on. Political gridlock in France as President Emmanuel Macron and his allies remain in dilemma after failing to muster absolute majority in parliament. An opposition leader has dismissed any kind of coalition with Macron's camp.
We campaigned in the opposition against Macron's majority, against his government, and we remain in the opposition in a determined but responsible manner. Never will we block institutions, but it's out of the question to enter into a logic of a pact or coalition to participate in anything of this nature.
Well, the official, however, said there is room for case-by-case deals. He added, however, that it's only up to Macron to make his step in their direction and take their suggestions on board. Hours before the meeting, the leader of the Republican Party had described Macron as an arrogant who is calling for help. The president has just held talks with opposition leaders to persuade him to rally behind him. A potential coalition would enable the president to push through legislative reforms during his second term. The result of Sunday's election has dealt a blow to Macron's future agenda he had promised during the campaign. Okay, that's it about Europe. Now in Ecuador, indigenous people continue to pressure their government over its economic policies. Thousands have arrived in the capital from across the nation to join the chorus of protests. The march through the streets of Quito on the eighth day of the campaign, protesters are demanding fuel price cuts and controls on food prices. President Guillermo Lasso has announced a small increase in monthly subsidies paid to vulnerable people. But protesters believe the measure is not enough. The demonstrations have disrupted the economy, prompting the government to declare a state of emergency in six provinces. Scores of people have been injured and arrested in clashes with security forces over the past 2 years. Diesel prices have almost doubled in Ecuador. That's facing rising inflation, unemployment, and poverty. The coronavirus pandemic has even worsened the situation. A leftist with plans to upend the economy has won Colombia's presidency. The headlines couldn't be any clearer, but a real headline is about how Gustavo Petro has overcome decades of establishment rule in Colombia. The country is now part of the elite Latin American club that has moved to the left and away from Western dominance.
Colombia witnesses a historic moment as it votes in its first ever leftist leader. Gustavo Petro, former rebel and mayor of the capital Bogota, beat his businessman rival Rodolfo Hernandez in a tense election. The voting took place as the country is plagued by the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic and social unrest. Public dissatisfaction triggered massive protests in Colombia last year, but Petro has vowed to bring about profound social and economic change.
What's coming here is real change. Real change. That is what we are committing our lives to. We will not betray the electorate that has demanded that Colombia change from today.
Petro's victory demonstrates a continuing trend in the recent years that many countries in the region swing to the left, indicating in some sense that the world is about to witness a Latin American integration in light of ideological alignment between the governments.
So with the victory of the historic pact in Colombia, we are definitely seeing a new horizon for Latin American integration. Just several years ago, it was the same countries of Colombia, Peru, Chile that were, you know, in the forefront of forming groups such as the Lima Group, which was formed precisely in order to attack Venezuela and undermine regional integration, dividing the region, antagonizing other countries within the region. And now we're seeing a very different scenario with the shift to the left of Honduras, of Chile, of Peru, and a potential shift to the left in Brazil. This means that these kind of formations, which have been put forward by the United States, such as the Lima Group, are no longer possible.
Now, Petro's victory in Colombia and the possibility of a Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva win in Brazil have brought expectations for a new cycle of cooperation in the region. If Lula succeeds, Latin America's five biggest countries, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Colombia, and Chile, will be broadly speaking ideologically aligned and in principle open to establishing constructive bilateral ties.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on those clergy and quasi-clergy who are unaware of Islam but try to portray the capitalist and socialist economic models. In this episode, we are going to touch upon other parts of his testament in which he warns the clergy against being affected by rumors of those who are ill-wishers and enemies of the Islamic system. Stay tuned, please. When Imam Khomeini started his revolution in early 1960s, some of the ulema were opposed to him, even warned him of struggles against the regime of Shah. However, with the spread of the revolution, little by little, more ulema joined him. Nevertheless, a small number of these ulema continued opposing the Imam. During the first years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and establishment of the new system of government, Iran faced myriads of internal and external problems. These included the moves of the remnants of the royal system, efforts of separatists to damage national unity through creation of riots here and there, and most importantly, the plots of external enemies to overthrow the system, or at least to fully render it inefficient. The all-out Iraqi war in 1980s was the climax of these plots. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament to those who kept finding fault with the Islamic system instead of helping it through giving solutions, "I recommend to those who, due to some mistakes, intentionally or unintentionally, are strongly opposed to the Islamic Republic itself, and for God's sake, are active to overthrow it, thinking that this republic is worse than or the same as the royal regime, just to ponder honestly in their solitude and fairly compare it with the former rule and regime. Besides, they should pay attention that chaos, mistakes, and opportunism are inevitable in revolutions in the world." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, enumerates some problems facing the Islamic Republic system, such as the internal and external conspiracies, armed assaults, infiltration of corrupt elements in various government establishments, etc., and advises the ulema not to be deceived by media hype and rumors. He writes, "You should pay attention and consider the hardships of this republic, including plots, false propaganda, armed attack from outside and inside, inevitable infiltration of some corrupt groups and opponents of Islam in all government centers to make people discontent with Islam and the Islamic rule, being inexperienced of most or many of the authorities, spread of false rumors by those who have been denied or receive little illegitimate benefits, considerable shortage of judges and backbreaking economic problems, shortage of skilled and expert righteous people, and scores of other problems. Which one will be unaware of them unless being in the scene, in addition to those super capitalist persons who are proponents of the royal system and through ushery, profiteering, immense overcharging, smuggling and hoarding have pressured the destitute and deprived in the society to the extent of perishing and have been causing corruption in society. I humbly advise the respectable ulama not to be affected by these rumors and strengthen this republic for the sake of God and preservation of Islam. Imam Khomeini advises those who are hell-bent on toppling the Islamic Republic system that once this system is toppled, the substitute will be a regime that will be the flunky of either the West or the East. He writes in his testament, "The respectable ulama should know that if this Islamic Republic fails, it won't be replaced by an Islamic regime which is intended by Imam Mahdi, or one which is obedient to you. Either regime will be take power, which is intended by one of the poles of power, and the deprived of the world, who have enthusiastically turned toward Islam and the Islamic rule, will be disappointed, and Islam will be isolated forever. And you will regret your acts when the die is cast, and there is no use in regretting. If you expect everything to change overnight, according to Islam and the laws of Almighty God, it is a mistake. Such a thing has not happened and will not happen throughout the human history. And on the day that, God willing, the absolute reformer, Imam Mahdi, will emerge, you should not think that there will be a miracle and the world will be reformed in one day. Rather, the oppressors will be suppressed and isolated through efforts and self-sacrifices."
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Because each of us as a human being has a limited lifetime on earth, and many of us, in fact, I think I can say most of us, don't end up observing some of the realities of this universe, this world, this creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And what I mean by that is what involves and happens to mankind as a result of their own deeds, in this system. We don't live usually long enough to see and observe these events taking place. It takes too long. It's more than a lifetime for things that happen to civilizations to be observed. The only way you can know what happens, the only way you can see what the results of people's deeds are, is to look back and study what people went through, what they did, and what happened to them as a result of their own deeds. That's the only way you can do it. To learn from that and then be able to decide and find out what you need to do, what you should avoid. That's pretty obvious. That's what I think, at least some people, I consider it pretty obvious. I think it is pretty obvious for a lot of people. The reason why I doubted that and I second thought that is that unfortunately there are people that deny categorically this whole thing, because once you start denying this system being a creation of God and God being in charge and God having a system in place, it just becomes random. Yeah, something could happen in history. It won't repeat itself. It will repeat itself. All those discussions are there. But once you realize that, and if you study history by itself well enough, you'll come to that. Because of that approach towards history or towards this universe, that it's all haphazard, it's all random, it's all, you know, especially when it comes to people, because when it comes to other things, carbon dating can go back 4 million years because it follows the same pattern according to them. They haven't even observed it. But when it comes to human behavior, that's something that, no, it's just whatever. Because of that approach, when it comes to studying history, as far as I've seen, as far as I've read the various books that we've found and scholars of history, they don't really care about the details of it. It's just, okay, this historian says this, that other historian's opinion about this event was like this, A, B, C, or whatever it is. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't have any impact on your life. It doesn't matter what people before you did or didn't do and what happened to them, because that has everything to do with them and nothing to do with you. The Quran, however, tells us otherwise. God is God. He is the creator. He's created this universe with not only physical laws that apply to chemicals, to the cosmos, to planets and stars and meteorites and comets and whatever else is out there on a macro level and on molecular level or subatomic level, quantum level, all these laws that these scientists are spending time discovering are not the only laws in place. These are laws that God has put in place, but there's also laws regarding the human being and human behavior right in this world. We're not talking about the hereafter. The Quran tells us both those laws, and the Quran tells us and gives us examples to show us this is what happened. You're not going to probably see this, at least the entirety of it, you're not going to see it unfold before your eyes. It's too long for your lifetime. We barely can analyze the 10 years, 20 years, 30 years of our lives to say, okay, this is what I did, then this is what I did, and then as a result of listening to these verses, this is where my life was moving towards. Or when I wasn't listening, this is where my life was moving towards. When I changed that, then I started seeing results. It takes time for those results to start showing. That's in just one person's life. When it comes to a civilization, the life and the death, the initial birth of a civilization, and the death of that civilization, that's not something you're going to experience. You may experience part of it. You may suddenly experience the end of a civilization. You might be one of those that watches something unfold before your eyes. You might have been one of those that saw the Shah go down, for example, in the Islam in Iran, current day Islamic Republic. And for the Islamic Republic to be established, the start of that, you might have seen that. But to analyze what happened, how did it end there? How did that previous thing, whatever it was, end there? What caused its decline? They talk about the Roman Empire because that's the only thing the Westerners can think of.
That's the only civilization they have to show. And there's not really too much good in it, of course. But anyway, a civilization. Where was Britain during that time? Nothing. Nowhere. The Roman Empire. Well, there was a rise of the Roman Empire. There was the birth of the empire. Then there was a death of the empire. They talk briefly sometimes about the death of the empire, the downfall, the decline of the empire, but not with the right tools and the right understanding of what happens. Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala swears by wal-fajr, by dawn, wal-layalin ash, 10 nights, whatever those 10 nights are, a 10-night period of time. Wal-shaf'i wal-watr, pairs and single things, apparently, as some have mentioned. Shaf means pairs, and watr means single, something that's single, okay, single things. Not odd, because odd would include three, five, and so on. No, single, just one. Of, like, for example, the watr prayer. In the night prayer, you have the shafa'ah, it's called, and that's two rak'ah, and then watr is one rak'ah. So just remember that to understand what shafa'ah and watr mean. Now, what does this exactly refer to? What two things, pairs, I called them, and single things? What, just generally, some believe that. Anyhow, he swears by these different things. وَاللَّيْلِ إِذَا يَزْقَ. First by fajr, which is the dawn, when light starts coming in, and وَاللَّيْلِ إِذَا يَسْرَ is when it becomes pitch black. So when there is brightness, the crack of dawn, and when it's no light at all. Both of these are mentioned here. And he says, هَلْ فِي ذَلِكَ قَسَمٌ لِذِي حِجْرٍ. Is this not an oath, I guess, for want of a better word, that's the only word that comes to my mind, the swearing, these things that he swore by, aren't these enough for لِذِي حِجْرٍ, someone that has an intellect, someone who can think? Is this not enough to consider this important? These are, we take a look at wal-fajr. Do we understand the greatness, the grandness, how great fajr is, or just a time of day? What needs to happen in this universe, the sun and the earth, and this whole system that causes for dawn to occur? And then what's related to us from every day, every 24 hours, every interval of time, this daily thing, this daily routine, you have pitch black for most of the earth, not the entirety of the earth. You have pitch black moments, and this daily interval for some parts, it's not daily, but it's annual. Any part of the earth, you have a time where it's pitch black, no light, and there's times where there's light. After darkness, there's light. Okay. So isn't this something for someone who possesses intellect? Enough for them to think.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. English Radio.
in the limelight.
The U.S. leader is reportedly planning to offer a security pact similar to the Abraham Accords, finalized under his predecessor, to the autocratic regimes in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, says Trita Parsi, executive vice president of the Quincy Institute, in an article published under the heading, Biden's policy increasingly looks like Trump's West Asia strategy. Stay tuned for more. All the latest headlines about President Joe Biden's July trip to Saudi Arabia focus on a deal to push down gas prices. In reality, he's making a much more sinister and dangerous calculation than most realize. He's reportedly planning to offer the dictators in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, where all but two of the 9/11 terrorists came from, a defense pact that commits American lives to defend their regimes. What could go right? When Biden ran for the White House, he pledged to break with then-President Donald Trump's West Asia policy. Bring U.S. troops home from the West Asia-North Africa region, renew the Iran nuclear deal, end the war in Yemen, and make the Saudis the pariah that they are. But after refusing to take necessary steps to return to the Iran deal, and with rumors abounding that he is about to offer the UAE and Saudi Arabia a defense pact, Biden's policy is increasingly looking like a continuation of Trump's West Asia strategy. Biden isn't just forgiving Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for his direct role in the beheading of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in return for a Saudi promise to pump more oil. As Biden admitted last week, this West Asia trip is about regional security and that of the Zionist regime in particular. Biden told reporters on June 12th, "The commitments from the Saudis don't relate to anything having to do with energy. It happens to be a larger meeting taking place in Saudi Arabia. That's the reason I'm going. And it has to do with the national security for them, for Israelis," unquote. Rumors have been circulating in Washington for months that Biden is seeking to expand Trump's signature foreign policy initiative, the Abraham Accords, which normalized diplomatic relations between the Israeli regime and Bahrain and UAE. Biden wants to bring Saudi Arabia into a similar kind of arrangement with the fake regime of Israel. Details are beginning to leak of how he will try to get Saudi Arabia to take critical steps toward recognizing the fabricated regime of Israel. And the most alarming one is that the United States of America is offering a major security pact to autocratic regimes in Saudi Arabia and UAE. According to a source close to the ruler of the Emirates, this would be a binding strategic defense cooperation pact that goes beyond anything the U.S. has agreed to in the region before. A former Biden advisor, David Shapiro, confirmed to Newsweek magazine that Saudi Arabia was looking for assurances that the U.S. will retain significant military presence in the region to help Saudi Arabia address the threats it faces, as well as to take Saudi Arabia's side in its gruesome war in Yemen. Committing American lives to defend these Arab dictators is far more scandalous than an embarrassing presidential handshake with the Saudi Crown Prince. Biden will in one swoop break his promises of bringing troops home from the West Asia North Africa region, making Saudi Arabia pay a price and ending the war in Yemen. For the U.S., this amounts to an awful deal. It's all give and no take, because none of what the Persian Gulf states are offering is likely to pan out. To start with, establishing full diplomatic relations with the Zionist regime is a concession to this regime, not to the U.S. It does not advance U.S. security one iota. Nor does it bring peace to Palestine or stability to the West Asia North Africa region, which the experience thus far with the Abraham Accords already has proven. Indeed, peace is not really the objective. Rather, according to Jared Kushner's August 2021 annual strategy document of the Abraham Accords Peace Institute, the objective is to move beyond the Arab-Israeli conflict. In that spirit, the Biden administration has not pressed the Israeli regime for any concessions to the Palestinians as part of this agreement. Instead, Biden has requested that the Zionist regime refrain from any provocative actions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds that could inflame tensions ahead of his visit. Once his visit is over, Biden will presumably have no objections to the Zionist regime's ongoing repression of the Palestinians. Instead, and indeed, the Zionist regime's creeping annexation of Palestinian territory has accelerated since the Abraham Accords was signed. As Zaha Hassan and Marwan Mohasher write in Foreign Affairs, the truth is that the Accords have not advanced peace in the Middle East because Israel's aim in signing the Accords was to redirect world attention away from its military occupation, not to end it, unquote. This is not a recipe for peace, but for violence. Not surprisingly, during the first 3 months of this year, almost 50 Palestinians were murdered by the fake regime of Israel. The Palestinian deaths are a five-fold increase over the same period the previous year. Secondly, Biden's game is also unlikely to push down skyrocketing gas prices. Experts are skeptical that the Saudis sit on enough unused capacity to push down American gas prices substantially. The root of the problem is Washington's over-reliance on Saudi Arabia, a dependence that will only grow more damaging to U.S. interests as Biden moves closer to the Wahhabi kingdom at the expense of diversifying America's relations in the West Asia-North Africa region. Thirdly, Biden's defense pact is not likely to make the West Asia-North Africa region overall more secure. The Abraham Accords, contrary to claims that they are a creative new approach to the security in West Asia-North Africa region, continue a four-decade-long failed American strategy in the region. Perhaps the most important commitment the U.S. will seek to extract from Saudi Arabia and the UAE is alignment with America's strategy to confront Russia and China. The Saudis will make certain commitments about remaining fully aligned with the United States in its competition with Russia and China, Shapiro told Newsweek. But there is little to suggest that Biden's strategy of showering the Saudi crown prince and the ruler of the UAE, Mohammed bin Zayed, with concessions will bring about a sustainable Saudi Emirati commitment to the U.S. side in great power competition of this century. The Saudi crown prince has driven an uncompromising line with Biden. He famously shrugged off Biden's refusal to engage with him during the initial stage of his presidency. "I simply do not care," he told The Atlantic and patiently waited for Biden to cave. The Saudis are already dictating the terms of Biden's visit. forcing Biden to see the Crown Prince before he is allowed to meet any other Saudi official. Giving the Crown Prince more is not likely to make him more malleable, as political scientists Patricia Sullivan, Brock Tessman, and Chun John Lee's research shows that increasing levels of U.S. military aid significantly reduce cooperative foreign policy behavior with the United States. The most likely outcome of Biden's meeting with the Crown Prince is that Saudi Arabia and the UAE will pocket Biden's many concessions and offer tactical collaboration against Russia and China in the short run, while keeping their options open to betray Washington down the road. If they truly believe that they shouldn't risk against China and Russia in this competition, they would not have needed all these American concessions to align themselves with the U.S. Biden is now completing what Trump started.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Today, arrogant France grandeur is broken and nations talk against the US. February 17, 2022. One hears from some individuals that the revolution has strayed from its goals. This is not the case. If the country has strayed from the goals of the revolution, the enemies of the revolution would not have been so hostile to the system. The Islamic Republic and Islamic Iran, these hostilities themselves are a sign that the country and the Islamic Republic have been loyal and committed to these goals. One hears some people say that the system has strayed from the goals of the revolution, and they want to show that they are committed to the revolution. I do not agree with this statement, nor do I believe their attachment to the revolution. One who pursues an aristocratic lifestyle and whose path is an aristocratic one cannot believe and the slogan of supporting the barefooted. The slogan of the revolution is the slogan of supporting the oppressed and the barefooted. The people who seek an aristocratic lifestyle and whose movement is in an aristocratic movement cannot be faithful to this slogan. The slogan of the revolution is confrontation with arrogance and with the arrogant movement and with arrogant powers.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Those who speak about surrendering to arrogance and to the U.S. cannot be committed to this revolution and these goals. This is not an acceptable comment. And we thank God for bestowing the blessing on the Iranian nation to be resistant. The people endured, showed resistance, and were able to bring the country to this point. And God willing, this perseverance must continue. On a daily basis, not only inside the country, but also in the region, the endurance of the Iranian nation is influential. Today, as you can see, the resistance movement in the countries of the region is growing, and America's power has been broken in the region. Nations have become bold and are speaking against the United States and against their moves. Well, we must appreciate this and continue the movement of the revolution. My recommendation to our dear youth is to see today in which line the enemy is moving, what the enemy is aiming, and then to act and move in the opposite direction. In my opinion, the way I see things, the enemy has targeted the nation, public opinion, and the minds of the young people. They are spending billions of dollars in their think tanks, as they themselves put it, think tank and research circles, trying to turn the Iranian nation, and especially the youth, from this path.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.